Hello and welcome to Wattcast. My name is Roger Watson, and these podcasts are dedicated to readings of various articles that I've had published in newspapers and magazines. They reflect my views on politics, the pandemic, and current affairs. Thank you very much for listening. Hello, and once again, a slightly different podcast today. This is a recording of a lecture I gave at the University of Maribor in Slovenia on the 13th of March 2023, and the title of the lecture was Staying Safe from the Fakes and Predators. It was about open access publishing and predatory publishing.
Thank you, Gregor. Thanks very much. It's really nice to be back and to see one or two familiar faces. The world is getting back to normal gradually, but I can't believe how gradually it is in some places. We've got an hour all together, and I would plan to maybe talk for 45 minutes or so and have time for questions. I do have a habit of talking too long sometimes, but I'll keep an eye on the time and I'll try and come to a halt then. Yeah, Gregor asked me if I'd talk about something to do with predatory publishing and issue a kind of warning to people, colleagues and students about the predatory publishers, and also to try to give you some, mechanisms, some weapons in the fight against the predatory publishers. So what I'll do is press that for a start and get this up. I'll look at the rise of the open access movement, because that has really been what's one of the things that spurred the predatory publishers. They didn't really exist before the open access movement, which is about maybe 20 years old now or so. It's grown a lot in recent years. Then I'll have a look at the rise of the predatory publishers, which is what we're going to talk about today. And I'm also going to throw in a bit about ChatGPT, because Gregor asked me to, basically. It's not strictly to do with this, but just a very brief bit about it. And really what the aim of all of this is, I'm not going to talk about ethics here, but really what this is all about is helping people to publish ethically, because publishing in predatory journals is not only bad, wrong, dangerous in some ways. If you do it deliberately, it's a breach of ethics. I think people are beginning to recognise this. One of these days, like most of these subjects, maybe we'll be able to stop talking about it, because everybody will know about it and people will stop doing it. But I know that people still do it, and I have academic colleagues all the time. I'm retired now, so not so much, but they were asking me all the time before I retired, when they got an email on a daily basis, oh, I've had an invitation to publish in a journal which claims to have an impact factor of 20, and I've been invited to give a keynote at the conference, should I go? The answer is always no. So that's the basic defense mechanism, don't respond to any of these emails. So how it all started? Well, it all started really with the internet. Before that, there would be no point in having a predatory publisher. Nobody would have known about it. It would have been too expensive to set up. Hard copy would have been one of the big inhibitory factors in trying to set up a predatory publishing company. But now with the internet, it's easy to do. And of course, the World Wide Web developing on the back of that, which we all use every day, all the time, and we can't get away from it. But it's a two-way traffic. We can use it to find useful information, but the predatory publishers can use it to find us. And they find enough of us, and enough of the ones they find obviously respond to make it worth their while existing. And what people like Gregor and I and others in the room hopefully want to do is to strangle them and stop them doing this. And this is all part of that movement to do that. And of course, we've also seen along with the rise of online publishing and along with the rise of the internet, is a move from print to online. I mean, we no longer read journals like this anymore. Very rarely. I'm a member of a society which used to send out a hard copy journal. I quite liked to get it. It was quite nice to get it. It stopped a couple of years ago. And any hard copy is mostly gone. Most of the major publishers do not produce any hard copy now. So we're getting used to generating PDFs and reading things online, and that's really where we do things all the time. We read them on our phone, we read them on our tablets and on the computer. And of course, this is all ripe ground for the predatory publishers to exploit. So first of all, the rise of the open access movement, because that's relevant to this. This is a graph which is very much out of date, looking at the rise of the open access movement. Basically, in the early 90s, it didn't exist at all. It kind of began to rise around 2000, and this is from 2009, and there were 5,000 about 5,000 articles and about 5,000 20,000 articles and about 5,000 journals at that time. That's quite a long time ago, but it's the only graph I could find that really showed it quite so nicely. But now, if you look at the directory of open access journals, which I'll mention a couple of times as I go through this, which is a record of reputable open access journals, we hope, you'll find that there are something like 12,500 peer-reviewed journals there at the moment, and it's growing all the time. And it grows in various ways. New online journals come on stream. Some journals become online. The Journal of Nursing Management from Wiley recently became open access, and other journals develop hybrid models of open access and also online, and also hard copy. I've written extensively about open access, and I can send the links are in the PowerPoint, which I think I sent to you. I can send these articles to people if they want, and they might be interested. But I've given quite a lot of thought about the evolution of open access journals and also the problem of predatory publishers. And this was one that I was invited to write in a German legal journal for the Compliance Alliance Journal. And also I've reviewed in Research Outreach. I've done a series of four articles there, one on Paywall, the movie, a review again. Paywall, I haven't got time to go into it here, but Paywall is well worth watching. It's available on Vimeo to watch free, and it's about the rise of the open access movement there and the issues around open access. And I won't say more than that, but there's a review of it there, and the link there's a link to the actual link to the actual movie, as it were. There. Right. So just to make sure that you understand what open access models look like, this is a graph that someone gave this from. This is not my graph. Someone gave this to me. But there's usually an author. An author and a reader, that's, you know, we're the authors and we're the readers of articles. We write articles, and we're talking to the postgraduate students over the next couple of days about writing for publications, but we're also readers as well. So the intermediaries are the publishers and the outputs are the articles, and there are two different models here. One is where, this is the sort of traditional model, where the reader pays to view it. You don't usually pay individually, but your institution, your university, your hospital will pay for you to look at the article. But the open access is different. In open access, you pay the publisher to make your article open access, and that's the difference in the model. What you get for that money is that you get to own the copyright of the article, and you're able to use it in a much wider way than you would be able to do if the copyright under this system belonged to the publisher. You can put it up online, you can share it with people, you can do various things with it depending on the license under which they publish it. And then there's another model which is having to develop, which I'm not sure, I think you do have a repository. We certainly have one at Hull, and all UK universities have got them now. Repositories where people can put the final accepted version of their articles, not the published version. And these are funded by universities. So somebody has to fund that. It's not free, it's free to use. And with open access models, there are various ways in which articles can get into that repository. But at some point, nothing's free. Money has to change hands at some point. And of course, it's the fact that money has to change hands at this point that has spurred the predatory publishers to get in on the business. There's nothing for them at this end of the business, but there's lots for them at this end of the business, charging you to publish your article. And just a sort of static model which shows you a little bit more and also explains the different models of open access. Basically, the traditional model where you pay to view is a subscription model. It's got a wall or a firewall or a paywall around it. The open access model operates under different systems. Most open access is gold open access, whereby you pay the publisher to make your article open access. Where you have repositories for accepted version, that's called green open access. And there are some, but very few, platinum open access models, whereby you don't have to pay to publish and nobody has to pay to view, but they're very few and far between. I work with one called the Wiki Journal of Medicine, which is a diamond open access system. I don't have the time to go into that now either. But also societies like the Royal Societies of Medicine Surgery in the UK, they offer diamond open access, but of course you're paying for your fellowship. That keeps it going, but everybody can access it. So there are some, but not, there are very few. It's growing, you can see there's not much incentive to do it because it doesn't make anybody any money. And again, it's this system here that the predatory publishers are exploiting, the gold open access model. So how can you, one of the first decisions is about open access before we consider predatory publishers. How can you decide in which open access journals to publish? Because it's a big decision, because it can cost you a lot of money, or it can cost your institution or your research grant a lot of money. So considerations are really the cost, that's one thing. It can cost, I mean, if you want to publish with Nature, I think it's $9,000 to publish open access with Nature. That's ridiculous. And nobody can afford that, and very few, except the top institutions, Cold Spring Harbour and places like that. University of Maribor, no doubt, can afford that. My university at Hull certainly couldn't. And they are moving towards being increasingly open access. But most of them come in about $2,000 or $3,000 or so. Again, this is where the open access predatory journals get in. They charge you a couple hundred dollars. You know, they go for volume. Never go cheap. Sustainability. Will that journal be there in a year's time, 5 years time, 10 years time? If it's Wiley, Elsevier, Sage, BMC, PLOS One, you know, all the big publishers, Springer, Nature, it'll be there in perpetuity probably. But if it's a small open access journal being run by one small institution, I wouldn't go with it. And that model was quite common at one time. It's fading away a little bit now. And also reputation. You've got to be able to judge the reputation of the journal as well. Just because it's open access doesn't mean to say it's bad, but just because it's with a major publisher doesn't mean to say it's bad. You've got to use some judgment. And the best place to go, and I've mentioned it already, is the Directory of Open Access Journals. There are other places, as I'll show you, where you can go to check. If you find the journal that you're looking at there, you should be safe. It doesn't mean to say it's got an impact factor, which I know is important in Slovenia, but at least it's reputable. And the sort of information it gives you, and I'm showing, that's the journal Nursing Open, of which I was founding editor, completely open access journal run by Wiley. It tells you what you need to know about it. It's got an ISSN number, which is important. It's got an online presence, double-blind peer review, subject added to the DOAJ. The APC, the charge, the article processing charge, $1,600, and it's got a green tick, which means that they've it's been approved to be on there, and it tells you the particular model. These are open access models. No time to go into them. It's incredibly boring, but basically you've got to read the small print on the CC, the article, the licenses, the open access licenses, they've got a particular name, but it's so boring I've actually forgotten about it, but you do have to check, and there are different ones. But you can also check the Web of Science. Again, we know from recent events that not everything that's on the Web of Science is necessarily going to be reputable, but most journals are. If it's there, you should be quite safe to publish, and many open access journals are there. Sitting slightly below the Clarivate Web of Science is the List of Emerging Sources Citation Index, a bit of a mouthful, and that is a list of journals which are tipped to be on the Clarivate list very soon. So they've passed all the quality criteria, which they need to have, like double-blind peer review, being published in English, having regular publications, but they haven't quite made it yet, but they're going to be. And this is a really good source of open access on online journals. Lots of them are on there, lots of them are beginning to come in to the main Clarivate list. So you should be safe enough if you find it there. Likewise, PubMed, Scopus, and CINAHL, all the major databases. If you find your journal there, you should be safe enough to proceed. Okay, that's all I want to say about open access. We can have some questions later if you want to about that. And we can also decide whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, and I can give my opinion on that if you want. But I won't do it yet. What I want to move on to now are the predatory journals, which is the meat, as it were, and the sandwich between the open access and ChatGPT and any conclusions. And I want to look at the characteristics of the predatory journals. And this man, Geoffrey Beale, is the sort of hero of the predatory publishing movement, not a hero of the predatory publishers, a hero from our side. He's the man who really first spotted that this was happening. And he was a librarian at, he was at Ohio University at one time, and he compiled a list called Beale's List of Predatory Publishers, which had to stop a few years ago because he was taken to court by a predatory publishing company, or one that was on the cusp, and he no longer works for the university, and he no longer tweets about open access for some reason. But anyway, the list is still available, it's cached there, it's a little bit out of date, and people have tried to keep it up to date. There is a problem, which again, I know Gregor and I have talked about this, the specificity and the sensitivity of these lists. You know, there are some journals which are just on the, you know, are they predatory, are they not? You know, and it's very difficult to know. And the problem is that if you include or accuse a journal of being predatory and it's not, you can be in a great deal of trouble. For example, I'm recording this, so I better be careful. If I make a podcast of this, I'll bleep this bit out. But I think, and I'll say it without any hesitation, I think it's a predatory publisher. Yet is now in bed with producing their open access journals. Now, I'm not criticising for that, of course not. But if you create, if you say in the public domain that predatory, you better get a lawyer and a lot of money. You know, so you've got to be very, very careful. So there are some that are just on the cusp, and it's very hard to tell. But if I give you the characteristics of predatory publishers, you should be able to make some judgment yourself. And my view is, if in doubt, don't. You know, find somewhere else to publish. Wikipedia, which I'm very keen on, because I work with them, it's got a very good definition. I hope you can read it, but I'll read it out just in case. Predatory publishing, also called right-only publishing or deceptive publishing, is an exploitative academic publishing business model that involves charging publication fees to authors without checking articles for quality and legitimacy, and without providing editorial and publishing services that legitimate academic journals, whether open access or not. Most of them are open access. I don't know of any hard copy predatory journals. And it mentions Beale's list there as well. It also mentions ThinkCheck, Submit, which I'll come to at the end. This is the rise of the predatory publishers, Shark Tales, you probably see, and this is from 2000 up to 2016, and these are data extracted from Beale's List of Predatory Publishers, and of course it only is up to 2016 because that's when Geoffrey Beale had to finish updating the list and to leave his job, basically. And at this time it was reckoned there were about 1,000 or so predatory journals, predatory publishers, or whatever. Red indicates the publishers and the yellow. Red indicates the publishers and yellow indicates the journals. For some reason there are more publishers than journals. I can't quite work that one out. And you can also see here in blue the rise of what's called the hijacked journals. Now these are getting much more common now, and they're just predatory. Let's just throw them in with the predatory publishers. And they have a particular model whereby they mimic websites or find old cached websites and revitalize them and it looks like it's the John of Advanced Nursing, but it's not the John of Advanced Nursing. What will tell you that is when they charge you some stage along the process to sort of submit your paper. So these are rising. You've also got to look out for them. And again, if you come across anything suspicious on a web page, if in doubt, don't stop and check. Now it's reckoned from this website Predatory Publishing, which I think is legitimate, that there are now over 15,000 predatory journals out there. Some people say it's much more than that, but they do produce a list of journals and publishers, and it's quite useful. But again, the specificity and the sensitivity, you know, is doubtful about some journals. It's hard to be sure. Are they being too sensitive and picking up too many journals? Or are they not being specific enough? We don't know. And there's really no way of testing that. It's difficult to know. But as I said, again, I'll say it again, if in doubt, don't go ahead if you think a journal is predatory. So, I've written a few things which you might want, if you can get them online and you can have a read of them if you want to. Predatory publishers, what are they? And basically, we're going to run through a series of characteristics of predatory publishers. And there's quite a few of them. I won't spend too long on them given the time. But basically, they accept articles quickly with little or no peer review or quality control, little or no, sometimes there's none at all. And they even accept, you know, hoax and nonsensical papers. People have put in articles with just completely random jumble of letters and they've been accepted. There's one famous article which says something like stop sending me your emails. It's a word that you won't use in Slovenia, but a rude word, and it just says it all the way through the article, and that was published by one of them. You know, so they can be fooled, and it just shows you it's probably bots that are just putting these articles up. So hoax articles and nonsensical papers do get published here. Of course, with the rise of ChatGPT, one could probably have some fun. I'm not advocating that, but you probably could. Notifying, this is the really bad point, is notifying you only after the paper has been accepted that you've got to pay. So the heat is on you then. We're accepting your paper, but there's a charge. And this is where people who are not as familiar with the concept of predatory publishers get taken in. Well, I don't want to go somewhere else. It might get rejected. It might take a long time to do it. I've got my committee coming up for my PhD. I've got a paper published then. I'm going for a job, and they pay the fee. Sometimes they'll see their paper published online. Sometimes they won't. The point of these companies is to get your money. And don't forget, they want to get your money. They've also got your credit card number or your bank details. And you don't want to be giving those things to these people either, because they're criminals, basically. So that's one of the other signs and symptoms of these predatory publishers. They also aggressively campaign. One of the greatest things that happened to me when I retired was that my University of Hull email system closed down and I could no longer use it. Some universities allow you to carry on using your email system. I was glad not to, because I got away from the deluge of emails inviting me to submit articles. There is nothing you can do to stop them. You can spam them, they'll find a way through. They're very, very clever. Never, ever correspond with them, never ask them to stop sending them, because they assume that you're interested and keep asking you. They escalate things. I've tried to be clever and send rude emails back. Don't. It's just not worth it. You'll just get more and more emails. And of course, this is where people who are not, again, familiar with the nature of predatory publishers get taken in. They think that they get flattered. We've read your paper and such, it was excellent. We would like you to submit to us. We think it would be, we will accept it without, you know, people not familiar get taken in. Also, they aggressively campaign for people to serve on editorial boards as well. It's just the same thing. But if you say no, they sometimes take your details anyway and use it, and it's happened to me once. So again, listing academics without their permission, and it's very, very difficult for people to get off that list, because basically there's no one with whom you can communicate unless you're going to submit a paper. Email addresses at the bottom, unsubscribes, all these things are completely, they don't bring up any, they look as though they're going to have hypertext links, they don't. There's no way you can stop it. And some people have had to sort of go to court to get their names taken off, but it's very difficult to find these companies. Nobody really knows where they're located. Possibly some in China, some in South Asia, we don't really know. They all claim, of course, to be in Washington, D.C., but they're not. Appointing fake academics to editorial boards, just making up names, basically. And of course, people have actually offered themselves for service on these boards, and of course they don't vet that either, and someone put their name, they were FIDO or something, you know, they were in qualification, I am a dog or something like that. You know, people can, some people have a bit of fun with them, but it just shows they don't pay any attention to what you send them at all. All they want to do is get names up there. You can usually tell when you look at them, they've got appalling pictures. The pictures are all fuzzy and kind of distorted because they've taken it off the internet. They don't even bother to download a proper picture of you. This is the hijacked journals. They mimic other journals. They're basically wolves and journals clothing, and they're out to get your money as well. And they're not. These hijacked journals are really not interested in publishing at all. All they want is your money and your credit card details and bank details. Making false claims about the publishing company, such as a false location, almost inevitably it's in Washington, D.C. And it's the same companies, and it's usually just a P.O. box or something like that. These are the same companies that will invite you to conferences. And the conferences are never in, I don't want to insult any country, but be very careful. They're never in locations that aren't exotic. They're always in the Caribbean or, something like that, these are completely false. You'll turn up at these conferences and you'll find there's nobody there. So they make false claims all the way through their operation. They use ISSNs improperly. It's not difficult to get an ISSN. It's one of the easiest things to do. University libraries have lists of them. You know, if you publish a research report for your university, you go to the library. Well, we could anyway, but I'm sure you can here. And just have an ISSN number uniquely associated with it. They use an ISSN number, and it's usually for the same batch of journals. So every journal's got the same ISSN. That's not appropriate. They shouldn't be doing that. It's a misuse of ISSN numbers. So if you see a journal with published with 100 journals all under the same ISSN, you can be almost sure that that's a predatory publisher. Here's a good one, citing fake or non-existent impact factors. I was in a Saudi Arabia a few years ago, and I was being driven back to my hotel by one of my academic colleagues, who said, oh, by the way, I've just had my article accepted in the Journal of Nursing and something or other. It's got an impact factor of 14. I said, that's impossible, because at that time no nursing journal had an impact factor greater than 3. The first to have an impact factor greater than 3 was the International Journal of Nursing Studies. And he said, no, it's got an impact. I said, I can assure you it hasn't. So he then began to worry about what had happened to him, and I just said, you've been scammed. He said, I paid him $1,000 to put this. I said, well, okay, you've been scammed, and there's no way you're going to get your money back either. So, and he tried to unpublish the paper, but the problem is they do have your copyright. You know, if they publish that online, it appears, and if you publish yours in another journal, it will be picked up for similarity. So he was in trouble. Boasting about being indexed in places like ResearchGate. Anybody can get on ResearchGate, it's not a problem. You know, you need to look for the ones that I mentioned: Web of Science, Scopus, CINAHL, PubMed, DOAJ, Directive Open Access Journals. Even there, you're not 100% safe, but you're 99% safe. So they make boasts to try and attract you in. And of course, they also, if they have got, so some of these are just set up as publishing mills for the people who are associated with them. And they, the editorial team will publish lots and lots of papers themselves. So if you look at a journal and say that so-and-so's on the editorial board and there's, half a dozen papers by him or her, it's usually him's, not hers, for some reason, men are worse than women. But, you can be sure that that's a predatory journal. At the very least, it's a journal of very poor quality. So those are some of the characteristics to look out for. It's not really all that difficult. I mean, almost any one of those would indicate to you that something's wrong. But usually all of those will go together. Most of these journals will make all of these claims. So if you're alert and you've you've looked into it, you shouldn't get into trouble. As I say, people still do. So what happens if you respond? Here's a real email from a colleague. Because it's in the public domain, I've taken out the name of the journal just in case I get in trouble. But this is an email from a friend of mine in Saudi, again. I'm writing to seek advice for my friend, I think it was him. He was a victim of a hijacked journal. The name of the journal is whatever review. He paid $600, it's an APC. It's not very much money to pay for an APC. He later learned the journal was hijacked. He's emailed the journal requesting to retract the paper and to possibly refund the publication. However, until now we've got no response. Could I help? Short answer, no. He's lost his money. He's also lost the paper if it gets published. So people do get taken in. That's a real example. Real persons in real distress. And some universities, increasingly, if you do publish in predatory publisher, the university might discipline you as well. The University of Ulster in the UK in Belfast has taken very strong action against academics publishing in predatory journals. So the consequences of publishing in a predatory journal, first of all, you will jeopardise your reputation. It's very difficult to build up an academic reputation. It's very easy to lose it, and you could well jeopardise that. So it's good not to do this. It's a good thing to avoid it if at all costs. You could, in some places, jeopardise your career. I think that's going to become increasingly likely. I don't advocate being punitive really with people if they do, but I think some universities are rolling their sleeves up and getting ready to really knock heads together of academics who do this. I would rather that universities were more diligent about advising their colleagues and their students in which journals they should publish. I think universities could get together. I'm getting a little bit beyond the subject of the talk, but I do think that universities, either individually or as groups or subject groups, could get together and have a list of approved journals, for example. I don't think that could be too hard. Of course, you'll immediately get people who are not on the list trying to get on it, but there are things that universities could do rather than just leaving it up to academics. And most universities do not provide any training on predatory publishing, despite the fact that they're very concerned about the issue. You'll get no citations, of course, not citations that count anyway. You won't get citations that will count for your Hitch index or for your Scopus Hitch index. You won't get, because it won't appear on Web of Science or on any of the reputable sites that gather citations for these kind of metrics. So you'll have lost that, and you'll lose money. You've wasted your money because you won't get it back, and you've also lost the paper as well. If it gets published anywhere online, it'll get picked up and you can't publish. So the consequences are, to me anyway, are quite serious really. I think the reputation is the main one. Right, so finally, I've been kind of talking about this all the way through, I suppose, but predatory publishers and how to avoid them. First of all, don't be too worried, okay? But we haven't been frightening everybody, because I think it's actually not too difficult to avoid the predatory publishers. Be aware of the things that I've been saying, be aware of the characteristics of them, look for these characteristics. If in doubt, ask a colleague. Don't go ahead without checking, especially if you're haven't had so much experience with academic publishing. Do check and do try to verify that the journals you're thinking of publishing in are good ones. Because bearing in mind that very few of us get published in the first journal we go to, you've usually got to have a plan B, plan C. I think I'm on plan D or F with one of my papers at the moment. But it's not just one journal you've got to worry about. You've got to sort of try and have a range of genres that you have confidence in your field. So this sort of, again, this is running through, it's a similar checklist to the one I've had before, but this is a very good one from a lady called Crawford, published in 2011, quite a long time ago actually, but has the publisher started dozens of new open access titles at once? That's often a sign, not always, but often a sign to alert you. Do the published titles have very few papers, if any? It's quite possible to go to the, they always have a website, these journals, it's quite possible to go there and find nothing published there. They're also very clever at having the Journal of Nursing and Health and the Journal of Health and Nursing under the same ISSN. So they change the words about to make them look slightly different, but to sort of match what your area of interest is based on what you've published. The problem is once you've published, this is when they find out about you and what your interests are. They also have bizarre titles like the Journal of Nursing and Chemical Engineering, you know, so it shows you that there are bots just putting together words to try and find you. So these again are warning signs. Does the publisher send emails asking for manuscripts, commissions, or to serve on an editorial board? Well, of course, publishers and usually editors will invite you to be in an editorial board. Then you can check the journal. You may already know the journal. You may already know the editor. Or you may have asked to be on the editorial board, which is not wrong, that's quite acceptable. I can't think of any reputable journals that will send emails out inviting you to submit, except for special issues. And even then, you've got to be, you know, it's few and far between, and it's still worth checking. So if you get an email inviting you to submit to a journal, just ignore it, just completely ignore it. The problem at the moment for most journals is, and my journal is quite small compared with the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which was huge, but we're now inundated with manuscripts. I mean, we're getting about 50 a week or something like that. It's just become huge. It just was through these explosions every now and again. We don't want any more. We'd actually like fewer of anything. So we're not going to be trawling for them. We get plenty, so bear that in mind. Emails being sent to you, just ignore them. Do they fail to disclose qualifications of editorial board members or editors? You know, sometimes you can't find out who the editor is of the journal, although maybe one editor for a disparate group of journals, from nursing through to philosophy through to humanities down to engineering, one editor, that's impossible. Is the publisher's address not verifiable? Invariably it isn't. Click on the hyperlink, it won't take you anywhere at all, or it'll be a PO box in Washington. Post restaurant or something like that. And is there very little evidence of peer review? They should advertise their peer review process, they should say what it is, and if possible, they should be registered with COPE, the Committee on Publication Ethics. Some of them say they are. That's very easy to check with COPE. Email COPE, they're very responsive. No, we don't know anything about that journal, they're telling you a lie. So you've got to be sure that they've got a reputable, properly functioning peer review system. So, if you're concerned about a journal, when I checked this, for some reason it came up in tiny little writing, I'm so sorry, I don't know why this is. Check, I can't even see that myself. Check Medline, all the things I've spoken about already. Check PubMed, check Clarivate, check the Emerging Sources Citation Index, check Scopus and the Directory of Open Access Journals. So we're kind of back where we started. These are the things that will tell you if it's safe to publish in an open access journal. These are also the things that might tell you if it's a predatory journal. It's just the same process, really. They're so tightly interlinked, the whole open access movement and the predatory journals, unfortunately, are very closely linked. Finally, and I'm not going to go into, there's quite a lot of detail on the Think Check Submit site now. It used to just have that on it, but now it's got a lot. It's got a little video, which is quite interesting, goes through all the things you can check. It's got about a 10-point plan for checking, which I'm not going to go through here. But the website Think Check Submit, it's got a Vimeo link. You can check it from the PDF that you're sent. But essentially, it gives you mechanisms, if you're in doubt, for doing that, identifying trusted publishers for your research. Again, it goes through most of the things that I've said here, but just in case you didn't believe me, it's there presented by someone else, but it is very useful. And I think for new students, undergraduate students who are thinking of going into research and publishing, new PhD and master's students, I think the ThinkCheck Submit website's a really good training resource. And all the major publishers like Wiley, Elsevier, so forth, certainly recommend it. You know, I'm guessing that they support it in some way. So that's legitimate and very, very helpful. So finally, just a little word, a couple of slides about ChatGPT, slightly different from that. But I think what Gregor asked me to talk about this, and I think what we were thinking is that at some point, I think ChatGPT and predatory publishing is going to kind of come together. And I think this is, I'm going to talk to the PhD students about publication ethics later or tomorrow. I think ChatGPT is something that's going to have to come into publication ethics soon. And from the editing point of view, we don't really know what to do about it, I have to say. And Gregor and I have just published an editorial in the Cope newsletter to that effect. ChatGPT is an artificial intelligence source which essentially answers your questions and helps you to write things if you ask it the right questions. There's a very good article somewhere recently with The Conversation of somebody displaying how they wrote a complete article, what the best steps were to doing it, and how to ask the questions and how to ask multiple questions. I'm not sure that's the sort of thing we should be teaching people, but anyway, it was there. But it's a language model that generates human-like text based on the input it's received. I know nothing about computing or artificial intelligence. Gregor's the man for that. But I do know how this works because I've got an account and I couldn't resist having a go on it. And I've actually published an editorial in my journal, written by someone else, which used ChatGPT as a co-author, and we got in a lot of trouble for that. But it also got a lot of citations. It got picked up by Nature News, and the whole ChatGPT thing's gone viral. But then I've published or sent with that author an article to another journal, which we used ChatGPT to write. But we said that and we're waiting to see what their response will be. But for example, if you've never used it, you just set up an account, log in, and you can use a Google account to log into it. I asked it, write me a paragraph on open access publishing. And this is what I got. I'm not going to read it all, but it was perfect. You know, open access publishing refers to the practice of making research outputs, such as research outputs and all the rest of it. And I read through it absolutely perfectly, 100 out of 100, fast. You know, so the big danger is people can begin to use this for writing papers. Students can begin to use it. I'm not advocating this for assignments and dissertations. And we don't really know yet what to do about it. And as publishers, we're not exactly sure how to respond to this. We don't have a model yet. There's a Cope forum coming up next week, which I'm going to attend online, and they will begin to... It's only editors who can... Are you on the Cope forum, Gregor? The editors-in-chief can join it, but I'll certainly be reporting from that to as many people as I possibly can. There are other AI instruments, and a particularly one good one is SciSpace. And in SciSpace, you can draw in a PDF of an article, you know, some incredibly complicated article. Just say, give me a summary, give me a 100-word summary, give me a summary. That perfect, you know, does it? You know, so for doing systematic reviews, it actually could be quite helpful. You know, I thought. You know, so the possibilities from artificial intelligence are endless and suddenly become noticed by lots and lots of people. And the problem for academics is, I don't think until now, they've known whether or not their students have been using this. And the problem for editors is we don't actually know that we haven't been publishing articles that have been using this. And the other problem is, you know, we're only beginning, not we, but people are only beginning to develop tools to detect this. There are some issues with the way it writes things that can be picked up by tools. So I got a T-shirt. That T-shirt. That's not me, by the way. That's much slimmer than me. But I got this from one of my colleagues. That T-shirt. I don't mean ChatGPT. My wife knows everything. She thinks she knows everything. There. That's my wife didn't think that was very funny, actually. So right. Now, just before I finish, those of you, well, they're all I think nursing colleagues here. I'd like to point you towards an excellent resource called Nurse Author and Editor. It's published by Wiley, but it's actually published on behalf of the International Academy of Nursing Editors. Now, it's great. I'm a Scotsman, and we don't like spending money, so this is free to access, and it's written mainly by editors, and it contains useful what I would call nuts and bolts, very basic advice about things, like how to publish ethically. Hopefully soon we'll have an article on ChatGPT, because that's where we sent that article. It's got articles on how to structure an abstract, how to write the introduction to a paper, how to start the discussion, you know, all sorts of interesting, how to do a blog about your article, how to do a podcast. I've written here quite a lot, but there's a lot of really good material. And I would really advise colleagues to register for the emails from it. It comes out 4 times a year, or even to write for it. It's very, very, very good, worth looking at. Published by an excellent colleague from the States called Leslie Nicol. I think I've managed my 45 minutes exactly there, which surprised me. That's my email at NEP. That's my Orchid, if you want to check if I'm a real person. If you're incredibly bored, you can follow me on Twitter, although it's not a professional one, it's personal, so don't be offended. And if you use WeChat, if you're in China, that's my WeChat thingy there that you can scan. So thanks very much, and I really enjoy having some questions from you, if you want to ask me some questions or discuss. Thanks. I won't record your questions.
This podcast was produced in association with youpublications.com.